The following podcast is brought to you by the Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
Good evening, everybody. It's nice to be with everyone tonight. Somehow just sitting feels right most of the time now. Feels like the right answer to most everything. And just to come together and to be exactly where we are in this, you know, moment without so much picking and choosing, maybe. And Fugan called me out on referring to Zazen as sort of this radical thing, but it is really subversive. You know, I was thinking tonight, it's so punk, you know, and that the Zendo is really just an incredibly gentle, quiet mosh pit. Whether it's virtual or live, you know, it's pretty radical to do what we're doing, to come together and sit with a computer, no less, in silence and profile. It's pretty nuts, but feels pretty important to do it at the same time. So I'd mentioned in April, the last time I gave a talk, that I was thinking of giving a talk on consciousness and reality and mind. And fortunately, I spared you from that. And now, however, what happens to a Dharma talk deferred? You may want to, you know, sign off now before I get in over my head. But it is, you know, maybe what brought us to practice in the first place, maybe not so much as with a thought of what is reality and consciousness, but, you know, an event happens or some life-changing thing, good, bad, or indifferent happens that makes us really stand back and go, what is this? What is this? What is the nature of this? Why this? Why, if this, why this? You know, the deep, deep, deep questions. And so I think there are questions we circle back to again and again and again and again, you know, throughout our lives. They're never fully answered. But it's what kind of brings us to the cushion, you know, to say, let me open these holes in my head for a second. Let me open them up and just let what's there come in, you know, so that I can meet this moment and this moment can meet me, you know, just now. So I've been thinking about consciousness and, you know, what is this spark of light, if you will, behind our eyes, and where, you know, it's an old question, you know, but in my last talk, you know, my last talk was completely scatological. I talked about my septic system and fecal incontinence. And I probably should go back to that and just talk about shit, because that's what I know about. But here I am at the risk of giving another crappy talk. So I've been listening to this guy, Dr. Bernardo Kestrup, a Brazilian philosopher, metaphysicist, a long list of credentials. I'm probably late to the party and you've all read everything he's ever written. However, he's blown my mind a little bit. So I've gone into a deep dive with him. And his most recent book is The Idea of the World, a Multidisciplinary Argument for the Mental Nature of Reality. And so he dismantles kind of everything. He dismantles our materialist thinking processes that we base all of our sort of ideas, and on consciousness particularly, on this materialist idea that everything is nature, is made of matter. And if we look closely enough at the matter, we can find the consciousness. You know, oh, it maybe arose evolutionarily as a byproduct, and many, many, many theories around it. But they're all basically looking at something as measurable and quantifiable, quantitatable, if that is a word. You know, from the smallest, you know, atoms that maybe have spin, you know, to the largest things that have gravitational pull, they're all observable. And the paradigm of this has served us really, really well. Hey, we get to take off our masks today if we're fully vaccinated, because we looked at this really closely down to virus levels and were able to develop mRNA vaccines that have served us well. So I'm not suggesting for a second that this way of looking at things is a bad thing. It just doesn't meet all of our needs when we look at consciousness, because then you have to sort of say, where does that come from? So I work in a school now, so I get to talk to kids a lot. And, you know, I think of the way we've looked at this for a long time and just kind of decided, okay, you know, at a certain place, you can reach the bottom and that's far enough. But when you talk to kids, you know, but why? Well, why that? Well, why that? So, you know, I can say, oh, yeah, the moon rotates around the earth and the earth is rotating on its axis and it's rotating around the sun and all of this is happening. And but why? But why? And, you know, I can maybe get into, well, everything has gravitational pull and that's like magnetism and we're all floating in the. I don't know. I don't know. Our knowledge stops at our ability to observe and understand it from that perspective. You know, even when we get down to the level of quarks, you know, we've got, you know, we go quantum. And even that falls short, I think. And certainly, I'm not the guy to speak on this. I don't have a PhD in any of this. But listening to those who do, they're increasingly becoming sort of dissatisfied with the sort of paradigm of looking at it in this way. So now you're definitely wishing that I gave a talk about shit instead of talking shit about shit I don't know shit about. But at any rate, I would probably agree with you on that. However, I'm struck by Hostrup's theory's similarity to, as what Enkyo Roshi brought up on Sunday, the Prajnaparamita teachings. And he suggests that our individual skin sack of consciousness, this consciousness that's residing in Joan at this moment, is a dissociation away from the storehouse consciousness that is throughout space and time. It's just a dissociative blip on the radar, if you will, from what's always available to us. And he likens it, this is what I really love, he likens it to DID, dissociative identity disorder, as seen in psychiatric conditions of people who have multiple alters and personalities. And he sort of says, that people with DID, this diagnosis, in their dreams will often be able to have their separate alters communicate with each other as if, you know, not through them in another story. It's direct communication with their alters. And he sort of says, maybe that's what we are. We're sort of dissociative blips in this cosmic stew. And I'm sucked in fully. I just love it. You know, I'm with this idea 100%. And I'm thinking about it, and I'm thinking about it, and I'm thinking, where the hell is this Dharma talk going? So I go out into the front yard, and I sit in the hammock, and it's between a magnolia and a cherry tree, and I'm like, Joan, you're digging, you're painting yourself into a corner here. There's no talk here. There's no talk. And so I smell the lilacs that are at the end of their life. There's a bush kind of under the magnolia, poorly planted, not a great choice for where it is, but it's struggling to reach out and get enough sun, and it's full of blooms. And I smell that. And when the birds at the bird feeder realized I'm not leaving, they decided to come back. And so I got a little symphony of birds and lilac. And I went, yeah, okay, all right. Where am I with this? Oh, yeah. All the flowers were coming up. The poppies, the crocuses are gone, but the poppies are coming up. And I was thinking, you know, this is what Zazen does. It gives us an opportunity to sort of let go of the macro and the micro and to glimpse the truth. And I probably shouldn't share this, but that these two professors, Hostrup as well as Hoffman, David Hoffman, who's worked in the same area. Yes, he's a doctor who works in consciousness, said that actually seeing things as they are, seeing reality, is bad for the species. It goes against our nature. It's not, it's a Darwinian loss that we're really as a species built to procreate and survival. And he sort of says it goes in the face of that, but somehow here we are, these, you know, dissociative blips, if you will. So awareness of the non-dual nature of reality isn't so good for the species. We're served best by seeking species advancing behavior, he says. But what happens when we capitulate to the boundless nature of the ever interdigitating reality of the myriad realities throughout space and time manifest in this moment as this moment? I'm looking, at these rectangles on this screen, and there's little pixels, and they're coming into my eye and getting flipped, and the cones and rods are picking them up, and they're going through the optic nerve, and they're going back into my brain, and I'm processing it just like the camera on my computer is for you. It's very, very similar machine. And yet I know that that's Monica, and I know she's wearing a scarf, and it's red and it's yellow. But is the red and the yellow on the scarf, or is it in here? And those were all the questions I was asking. And you know what? It doesn't serve me. It was fascinating, and I'm fascinated by it. And I had to feel regret that I didn't study, harder in school, because this is what I should be. I should be a, consciousness, PhD, doctorate. This is fascinating, And then after doing this deep dive, I kind of thought, wait a second, lilacs. The smell of lilacs. That's all I have to say. What else is there to say to this? But that said, we've had much, much better Zen priests than I that spoke to this, I think, directly. And I'm going to give you a chunk of it that's one of my favorite parts of the Genjo koan. To carry the self forward and illuminate myriad things is delusion. That myriad things come forth and illuminate the self is awakening. Those who have great realization of delusion are Buddhas. Those who are greatly deluded about realization are sentient beings. Further, there are those who continue realizing beyond realization, and those who are in delusion throughout delusion. When Buddhas are truly Buddhas, they do not necessarily notice that they are Buddhas. However, they are actualized Buddhas who go on actualizing Buddhas. So working with kids, I really get to see this. I think I get to see Buddhas actualizing Buddhas all day long. Kids do it great. I think to a certain age. I'm not a child psych, but I think at a certain age, probably they pick up all those bad traits in their dissociative ripple in the cosmic stew, get trapped in their own little wave of it, and miss that they're in the stream. So I work with this child who's got SMA, spinal muscular atrophy, and he uses a power chair. Like he's Mario Andretti. I'm sure there's a better reference for a speed racer than that. Probably shows my age, but like that. And many of his classmates often show me their actualized self, and in so doing, actualize myriad other beings. And perhaps children, just haven't been sucked in fully. And I remember this story, I think they're free in that river. They're not holding on to a branch on the shore of it. They're just free. And Enkyo Roshi, hi there. Yeah, I'm giving a Dharma talk. Yeah. Can you wait just a second? Maybe you want to get on the couch. So you'd given Roshi a Dharma talk on tubing. She was on a stream tubing years ago. And the water, I think, and I may be mishearing it, but I was seeing it through my dissociative cosmic stream. The rapids were pretty fast, and it was much faster than she expected. And she had an opportunity to grab a branch, by the side, and held onto that branch, because, whoa, this is too fast. Until she realized, actually, I'm hurting myself more with this holding on. Water is rushing over me and into my mouth, and this is no good, until she let go and found her balance and probably swallowed a lot of water and wasn't really happy about the experience. But clearly, my pixels are on the screen of Enkyo Roshi, so she's in my consciousness now, so I think we're okay. But and maybe that actually proves that we're wrong about it being not so good for the species, that sort of capitulating to the storehouse consciousness, if you will, that we do in Zazen. Maybe it serves us. And I've been moved to tears many, many times over these past couple of years working with these kids, with the kid I work with directly, as well as the other children in his class. And I never wanted kids. I think I was a queer guy of the 80s. And so maybe I had some sort of reaction formation thing about it. Like, if I can't have them, then I don't want them. But I don't think I was something that was on my radar per se. Steered away from pediatrics a little bit in nursing. I was like, ah, they're scary. They can't tell me, articulately what's going on for them. I've got a boo-boo. It's an owie, and I don't know what that means. It's hard. So, but that said, I've enjoyed my nephew, my niece, my nephews, other kids, that friends have. And now I get to have this incredibly special relationship with this one boy, as well as his classmates. And it's only recently that we've been able to work together again. He's back in the school physically just this past week or so. And it's been great. So I've been moved to tears by the kindness of these children many, many, many times, and their desire to ensure that things are fair, that everyone gets a turn, that no one is left out. It's just in their nature, and I'm amazed at it. There's no prompting needed. And on May the 5th, we all got to go to the gym, and had a little activity in the gymnasium. So all the kids got like six or seven, index cards with math problems and spelling words on them. And then they stuck them all over the walls of the gym. And then they would have to run to the different stations and find the number on the card of the 50 questions that were there and write the number down and then do the math problem or do the spelling word. And then as a break, when the Star Wars theme came on, you had to run back into the center court and get a pool noodle for a lightsaber and have a lightsaber battle. And then when the music stopped, you'd go back to the walls and you'd do more math questions and spelling words. So these are the moments with a kid with a difference in ability as the nurse that works with him that I always go, and I have that sharp intake, like, is this the moment that we're not going to be included? That feels like I notice this difference in ability that I'm not taking care of somehow. But without prompting, with no prompting from an adult, we take off and we go to the first wall and a kid just steps out of the way. It's not a, oh, I'm stepping out of the way because there's a child in a wheelchair. They just do it. It's like the koan reaching back for the pillow in the middle of the night. It's just reflexive in a child and it moves me to tears. Like even now, I'm just moved. So of course the kids want to put the post-its high, high, high on the walls, because you're a kid and you want to jump up and slap that thing on the wall as high as you can do it. But Devin can't see him. And so they just reach up, move it down so he can see it. Again, just like reaching back for that pillow in the middle of the night. And I want to weep. And then the music starts. And I'm like, uh-oh, here we go. This is the part where the difference in ability is glaring. He's going to have a hard time holding that pool noodle. Oh no, I got to get over there, ensure that he has one, and see if I can negotiate a kid that's gonna. I turn around and there's three kids holding up pool noodles, for him, ready to battle. They want to battle him. And, I'm kind of like, yeah, he doesn't have great grip, you guys. You can't just knock it out of his hands. It's not going to be fun. I want to say all that. But before I can even do that, hold it with both hands, Dev. You'll get a better hold on it that way. And they play gentle and not like a parent winning the, letting their child win a race. It's not that. It's an egalitarian, equal, free. We're here to play. It's about being in the stream. And so they actualize themselves together in the game. It's so heartwarming. I can't even tell you. It's you see it and it's woof, it gets you. So on the elevator ride back upstairs, because we are in an upstairs classroom, we get to ride the elevator, and that's awesome because if you're seven and you're in a wheelchair, the elevator is awesome. And that's also a place where we have secret potato chips. So we were having some secret potato chips in the elevator, and he said, I did good today. And I said, you're a stormtrooper. And he is. So I've made a decision to leave this job. And it has not been an easy decision at all for me to make. I'm not going to be there next year with him. And I had no idea that I was going to enjoy working there as much as I have. And I had no idea that I was going to meet a Buddha who was going to teach me about patience and resilience and courage and perseverance. Had no idea that was going to happen. So I knew I had to tell him myself. I had told his mom, and that was a hard one. And I had told my principal and, you know, some of my coworkers. So that I put in my formal resignation, but I hadn't resigned to him yet. And I was going to do it on Tuesday, and I chickened out. I just, you know, totally chickened out at the last minute. I was like, have a good day. As he drove off into the sunset, and I was like, Mom said, did you do it? I said, no, I couldn't do it. And then this morning, I got a text from Mom that I came up in conversation as they were getting ready for school, and the beans had been spilled. You know, so he had talked about how great Mr. Tibbetts was. And so she thought, uh-oh, we better have this conversation now. So he was a little teary when we got on the bus, but we worked it out. And he, you know, sort of said, it's time for you to go help other people. You know, that was his take on it, and so gracious and big. So when I met him at the bus, he said, he said, we're not finished here. Said, no, I'm not going anywhere. We're not finished here. And he said, okay. And he like looked at me like, you better stick to it. And I was like, I got you, but I'm here. So, we're planning some barbecues, and I very well may be working with him over the summer anyway. But I came into this job, you know, very much a nurse. Nurses like things called SOAP notes. SOAP notes are situation, objective, assessment, what's the P? I can't even remember. But we want, you know, it's got to be data. We're data driven. Like, what's the problem? How are we addressing it? What have we done? What is the, you know, end of that? How's it all tied up in a nice materialist view? You know, it's got to be things, and things are fixed. And this just didn't fit into that paradigm, you know, so much. So, you know, we're looking at reality as nurses, but we're looking at it as dictated through our dissociation, through our ripple. And maybe when we don't see the cosmic soup of it all, we do that patient and that student a disservice. You know, obviously, you know, we've got to intervene. We've got to do all the things that are important. But can we step back for a second? Is there just a moment, even in emergency care, there's a moment as you're doing chest compressions where you can say, what's going on here? What is all of this? So at recess, there's a swing outside that's adaptive. And it's one of those moments that I think he gets to forget about his difference in ability. The wheelchair's off to the side. It's not really visible. And he's just on a swing like all the other kids. Sure, he's got a, you know, pusher who's there for him. But, you know, he's just free to be in his chair. And as he was swinging back and forth today, he said, I'm going to touch that plane with my toes. And there was a plane going by, you know, and I thought about being in the hammock, you know, and swinging back and forth in my hammock. And, you know, sort of like, what's more important than the smell of lilacs or bird songs or touching a passing plane with your toes? What's more important than that? So on the bus ride up the mountain to his house at the end of the day, the bus driver had the word that, you know, I had resigned and that Dev knew about it, and we were having a conversation about it. And she said, you know, Dev, you know, Mr. Tibbetts has been a big help for you. And without skipping a beat, he said, I think we've been a big help for each other. And Dev, you have no idea. You have no idea. There's a, I think of it as the Buddhist precepts for elementary school. When you walk in, there's a big picture of a pineapple on the wall, and it says, be a pineapple, stand up straight, wear a crown, be sweet on the inside. And, you know, it's such a simple thing. Stand up straight, wear a crown, be sweet on the inside. And that's what Devin does every single day. So I'm going to leave you with a haiku by Katsushika Hokusai, who was, I guess, a student of Basso, same period or shortly thereafter. And it sort of speaks about this talk. A poppy blooms. I write, erase, rewrite, erase again, and then a poppy blooms.